what's happening in these states are them pursuing the mechanics to first put in their own people as election oversight officials. They can seize the mechanisms of our elections and impose their will and then continue to change electoral laws until they can install themselves in power for the foreseeable future. People need to inform themselves and educate themselves. And they have to do it in a hurry because the next round is the 2022 elections. I think that the only hope we have is some kind of massive and very well-informed civic action.
Welcome to episode 98 of the Refuse Fascism podcast. This podcast is brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of the show. Refuse Fascism exposes, analyzes, and stands against the very real danger and threat of fascism coming to power in this country. And I'm glad to be back. Thanks, Mark, for covering for me. I have to start by sharing this incredibly sweet email I received. Quote, love your talk with Chelsea Evan. I may be a 72-year-old white man, but it is your generation that I learn from and who inspires me. Way too many of my generation betrayed the ideals of the 1960s. You are not alone in our shared struggle for racial, gender, and economic equality. We may be pessimists in our mind, but we always preserve optimism in our hearts. I wear your Refuse Fascism cap proudly, also very warm in the Minneapolis winter. In solidarity and keeping our hearts on the left, Harold, an old Midwestern socialist. Thanks, Harold. Now, go be like Harold. Go to refusefascism.org and get your hat, and go back and listen to Male Supremacy Common Ground for Fascists. By the way, Harold, what generation do you think I am? In today's episode, we're sharing a listener-requested interview with Ann Nelson, author of The Shadow Network, Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. But first, let's talk about some developments from this past week as it relates to the rising fascist threat and the importance and impact of standing up against it. It seems that despite Rand Paul's encouragement, the Super Bowl won't be the site of a trucker insurrection. But the fascist convoys in Canada, on the border, and now getting organized in the United States are not going away, and have seemingly been given direction and focus towards a convergence on Washington, D.C. on March 5th. This is not the expression of popular or legitimate grievances. Like the Tea Party and January 6th, these fascist movements are primed and funded from the top, projecting nightmarish visions of quote-unquote freedom, shifting the boundaries of what their suit and tie leadership can get away with. The trucker quote-unquote protests are not just being co-opted by fascists. At their core, they are anti-science, pro-virus movements led from the top of the fascist hierarchy with explicit goals of ousting liberal leaders. Many of their online organizing spaces are simply anti-vax, pro-Trump Facebook groups with new names. Their spokespeople are known white supremacists and not just Tucker Carlson. And major backing is coming from the same people that have funded anti-vax actions from California to Washington, D.C. And many have pointed out that they aren't being dissuaded as Democratic governors in the U.S. and provinces in Canada are lifting mask mandates and easing restrictions. No. No matter how accommodating a quote-unquote liberal government is to their demands, or even how similar individual policies may be, these fascists will always see them as illegitimate. They aim to take January 6th to its bloody conclusion. More and more information has been coming out this week about Trump's looting and destruction of documents. What strikes me about this is how we now have clear public evidence of an entirely new set of crimes committed by the former president. And there doesn't seem to be a flicker of a thought of actual prosecution. It's been reduced to a scandal, as though he wore an ugly suit. And while you can't talk about the fascist threat without talking about the Supreme Court of the United States, last Monday, with a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court has halted a lower court's order that required Alabama to redraw its congressional map, which diluted Black votes in direct violation of the Voting Rights Act. This is another major blow to the already battered Voting Rights Act that will likely preserve Alabama's current racist gerrymander. As Mark Joseph Stern of Slate makes clear, quote, five justices saw fit to break their court's rules to deprive Black voters of a hard-fought, richly deserved victory. In doing so, they effectively insulated racial gerrymanders in other states, including South Carolina and Louisiana, from invalidation. And by extension, they handed Republicans more whitewash seats in the House of Representatives. The court's order is not merely partisan. It is a lawless assault on the one remaining provision of the VRA, Voting Rights Act, protecting Black Americans in red states from political oblivion, end quote. The assault on voter rights that is sweeping the country is a key plank of the fascist strategy for a vengeful comeback, and we will be covering more in depth in upcoming episodes. As the possibility of war between U.S.-backed forces and Russia over Ukraine becomes more and more likely, I want to take a moment to share my personal perspective. We have the responsibility, first and foremost, for what our government does, and nothing short of a humanitarian nightmare, including the slaughter of civilians, would come about from a war with Russia. We need to be paying attention to what is happening and oppose all the threats of all imperialist actors. But in particular, in this country, we need to be clear that the rulers of the U.S. are not the good guys, and they are not fundamentally doing anything different than Russia, seeking to advance their interests, imperialist, and risking war to do it. So I really want to share the interview that I did with Anne, but I want to talk first about something we disagree about. And I know it's weird that I'm talking about it before you listen to the interview, but well, it just didn't seem right to do it afterwards. Anne and I agree that disinformation is a huge problem. And so I'd recommend that folks go back and listen to episodes of this podcast where we talk a lot about it. For starters, check out the episode with Federico Finkelstein about fascist lies. There's also one with Ruth Ben-Ghiat and another with Susan Neiman. It's a good place to start. But the solution to that, this disinformation, is confronting people with the truth, not just in one-on-one conversations individually, but as a political force, not finding common ground with people who are part of a fascist movement, but setting different terms with the majority in this country who don't actually want a fascist future, setting those terms. And the role of the masses of people getting in the streets in sustained action against fascism cannot be overstated. Action that is, yes, nonviolent. Such action likely makes them and maybe you uncomfortable. Take a moment and think about the integration of sports. Cities weren't asked, hey, you want Black people on your team? No, they integrated sports because if it had been done differently on the terms of you want integration, just think of what the response would have been in huge parts of this country. Meanwhile, it is overwhelmingly clear that these fascists had declared a war, seeing the way things are as intolerable, and any government they don't dominate as completely illegitimate. And to be honest, it's not anti-fascist protests that gives them ammo, but the lack of it that gives them a clear field to advance across. I say in the discussion that this isn't about economic grievances, but don't get me wrong. There are grievances aplenty. Vicious resentment against any limitation on white supremacy, misogyny, and American chauvinism. This is why on the show and in general, Refuse Fascism has kept making the point that there can't be reconciliation with this other than on the terms of these fascists. Trump and his supporters, remember, nearly succeeded in pulling off a coup that would have resulted in his remaining in power. In defiance of the outcome of an election, in defiance of the peaceful transfer of power. And things have moved. They're continuing to rapidly move beyond the situation we were in 2020 during the election and its immediate aftermath. And let me be clear, it's not in like some positive, not fascist direction. At the same time, what can be rightly called, what we rightly call the decent people who are opposed to these fascists, there's way too much of this fairy tale feeling that this will all work out, with experts and leaders constantly trying to dance this tightrope between sounding the alarm, but not so much that you have to do anything that makes a difference. And I just feel like we can't say there was a coup attempt and then say they don't have a shot at doing it again. We keep hearing that the election system is under attack, and in the same breath that the elections are the only answer. So I am so glad Anne and I connected and that you'll get to hear this interview. And I hope you'll read her book. These struggles about what we face and what's needed are extremely precious, and I look forward to hearing your thoughts. Cheers to the more than 100 students that staged a walkout at Huntington High School in West Virginia after an assembly at their public school, which featured a evangelical Christian preacher who told them they'd go to hell if they did not follow the Bible. Hey, hey, ho, ho, the fascist convoy has got to go. Cheers as well to those Ottawans counter-protesting and blocking the convoys. More of this is needed. The power of the people is in the streets. Stopping fascism can't be done from the sidelines. Big salute to these courageous people who are now waiting for a savior from up on high. And lastly, cheers to the women in Colombia schooling us on how to fight for abortion rights. Check out the video on our Instagram at ReviewsFascism for what I'm talking about. Now, my interview with Ann Nelson. Today, we're chatting with Ann Nelson, author of Red Orchestra, The Story of the Berlin Underground and the Circle of Friends Who Resisted Hitler, the author of Suzanne's Children, A Daring Rescue in Nazi Paris. She is contributor to the Washington Spectator and the Times Literary Supplement. Ann is also a professor at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs.
My title has now
changed. Okay, good.
A research scholar.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
I am now researching and writing full time, but still with a valued connection to Columbia.
That's beautiful. Beautiful. And her latest book and the topic of today's conversation is The Shadow Network, Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right, an in-depth investigation into the network of fundamentalist organizations and their oil barons who have carried out a multi-generational undertaking to control all levers of the government in the United States and well beyond. And this book, originally published in 2019, now you can get it and it's in paperback and it has an update post the January 6th coup attempt. So be sure after listening to check out the show notes where a link to the book will be featured. Welcome, Anne, and thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much.
So let's start with a simple but really important question to begin with. Lots of people have never heard of the Council for National Policy, while much of their lives in many ways have been shaped by this organization. And so first of all, what is it? What is the Council for National Policy and what do they do?
So the Council for National Policy, also known as the CNP, is a coordinating organization. And it's not that it takes so many actions itself. What one of its prime members, Richard DeVos, Betsy DeVos's father-in-law, said is that it brings together the donors and the doers. So let's take the DeVos family. They're sitting on $6 billion of Amway money in Michigan. Betsy DeVos and the rest of the family have been all about undermining public schools, public school teachers unions, secular classrooms. They're all about promoting the idea of religion in the schools. They use their money to fund organizations such as the Family Research Council, which has activist wings of people who actually go in and work with pastors to try to get voters in the congregations to vote Republican. They have media wings. They coordinate with Salem Media, which has thousands of radio stations that use their content. They also have all kinds of digital platforms pushing out their messaging. And so they decide on basic campaigns where they can swing unengaged voters, or sometimes they're swing voters in certain states, to go their way, which is always to the right wing of the Republican Party. And they will take an issue that hasn't been a particularly hot button issue in the community before, such as abortion, which is a big favorite of theirs, and they distort it. So they say, oh, Democrats think that a woman should be 9 months pregnant and walk in and say, I changed my mind, abort the baby, which is not true. You can't do that anywhere in the United States, and nobody supports that idea in the Democratic Party and beyond. But they say they do. And so they send out all kinds of mailings, do all kinds of messaging that say that Democrats want to execute newborn babies. And these lines have been repeated by everyone from Donald Trump to Ted Cruz, as well as their media. So that has been a pretty successful avenue for them over the last few decades. Now they tried many maneuvers to bring Donald Trump to a second term in office. They were getting a lot of their court appointments followed through in the federal courts, including the Supreme Court. And a lot of decisions are coming down that reinforce their power and influence. And right now they are on overdrive. And one of their projects, which we see very visibly before us, is taking over school boards and disrupting public education on a local level. So that's why the title of my book is Media, Money, and a Secret Hub. It's not that the Council for National Policy says we are executing this action. They hold several meetings a year where people like Ginny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, will chair sessions that say, okay, how do we manipulate electoral processes and election officials in these states? How do we get our partner organizations like the National Rifle Association to do deep canvassing door to door in the states we need to win? And the interesting thing about it is that they are not the Republican National Committee. The RNC is one of the earliest organizations that they've taken over. And there's still a few of the traditional Republicans, like Adam Kinzinger and Jeff Flake, et cetera, who say, no, no, this is not what the Republican Party is about. But their answer is, well, it is now. It's been a kind of viral takeover over four decades, I should add.
January 6th, for this movement that in Refuse Fascism we call fascist, it really was a watershed moment for them. It was decades in the making, but it was a new point in the way that they've previously operated. Can you tell us some of how the Council for National Policy was involved January 6th, how it was not their necessary first choice of actions, but an action that they chose to take?
Yeah. And for people who really want to know the detail about this, I would refer them to my Washington Spectator piece. What that lays out is the MO of this organization. And the way I describe it is plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D, on and on through the alphabet. I mean, they are indefatigable. And plan A was Trump wins the election, wins the popular vote, wins the Electoral College, takes office. Over a year before the 2020 elections, it became pretty clear that he was not going to win the popular vote in the Electoral College. So like, all right, plan B is he'll lose the popular vote, he'll win the Electoral College. Well, it became gradually obvious that he was not going to take the Electoral College. They couldn't depend on that. So then they started, as they moved into November, looking at different options. And after the actual vote took place, you had Trump getting on the phone with Brad Raffensperger, the election official in Georgia, along with this Council for National Policy expert on election mechanics, Cleta Mitchell, who was on that call where Trump told Raffensperger he needed to magically find 11,000 votes for him that didn't exist. So that was plan C, but Raffensperger, although he was a Republican, said, no, that would be unethical. Those votes don't exist, and I'm not going to fabricate them. So then they went on to plan D. Plan D started to involve the protest on January 6th, and members of the Council for National Policy, including Ginny Thomas and Charlie Kirk from Turning Point USA, tweeted various kinds of support for the protests in advance. Jenny Beth Martin, who is another influential member, was present along with another member, Simone Gold, who runs their COVID disinformation process. And so they converged on January 6th on Capitol Hill. Simone Gold was actually in the rotunda of the Capitol building, making speeches against vaccinations, by the way. So I think that there was the hope that the electoral college ballots would be captured, destroyed, or otherwise rendered inapplicable. And so that failed. But there was a possibility of causing a degree of chaos where it might have meant nullifying the elections and giving Trump another chance to claim office through a different means. And of course, as you mentioned earlier, I wrote a book about the Nazi period in Germany. You had this moment with the Reichstag fire, where Hitler had not actually won control of the entire German government, but with the Reichstagsfire, and we still don't know who said it, but he declared a state of emergency where all civil liberties were suspended, elections were over, and he was able to seize power in that way. So all of these plans failed, and it's pretty stunning to think how close we came. Biden won the popular vote by 7 million votes. He won the Electoral College votes by 44 votes in three states. Okay, that's nothing. That is less than the population of my little hometown in Oklahoma. 44,000 votes in three states. So that's how the Electoral College was won. Then you get to January 6th. We're still pondering why Mike Pence decided not to follow through with the plan. I don't know why. We also know that the Electoral College ballots were saved by a couple of courageous young congressional staff members who physically safeguarded our democracy, putting themselves at risk. Well, that's a pretty narrow margin as well. So once those attempts were foiled, what happens now? I described January 6th as the dress rehearsal. And what is happening now is that the member organizations and partners of the Council for National Policy are very, very busy at a state level. What people need to understand is that 30 of our state legislatures are controlled by Republicans, and there is an obscure clause in our Constitution that says under certain circumstances, state legislatures can decide that an election is challenged, and they can dispense with their own electors chosen by the voters of their state and appoint their own. That is in the Constitution. So a lot of what's happening in these states are them pursuing the mechanics to first put in their own people as election oversight officials. So they can challenge an election on spurious grounds. They can make things up. Once they do that and they throw it to the legislature can say, oh, well, we'll choose electors that will choose our Republican candidate regardless of what the vote is. So that is a real and perilous possibility. That is before us. So if that happens, it doesn't matter who votes for whoever in 2024. They can seize the mechanisms of our elections and impose their will and then continue to change electoral laws until they can install themselves in power for the foreseeable future.
I really appreciate your helping us step back to look at really what is the state of the landscape, so to speak. What has transpired, and people need to really take a sober look at where things stand. Amongst a lot of people, there was a sense of false relief that came, that it didn't happen, you know, that they weren't able to consolidate power without looking at how much they got away with and what trajectory they have now really committed to. The they, in case it wasn't clear, is the GOP, for lack of a better. Yes, there are minor exceptions, but really, this is something that the GOP as a whole has taken under. So I just want to express real appreciation for you kind of taking a very clear-eyed look and forcing people to look at what it is we do face. And one of the things that looking now at how the Council for National Policy has adapted their, let's say, election subversion plans post January 6th. Part of looking at that, one thing that you've paid attention to and others have pointed out is some of what's happening at the state level, including the focus on education and what happens in the schools. And I was wondering if you see a connection between the anti-science disinformation movement around COVID and overlap between that and the anti-education movement, is what I call it, the quote-unquote anti-CRT movement. Is there overlap? How do you see that? What should we understand about that relationship or lack thereof?
Well, I think people need to understand a couple of separate things before we get to that question. One is that the future of our democracy happens to rest on a very few swing states. So, for example, I live in New York. New York goes Democrat. It's going to go Democrat whether my neighbors go and campaign on the corner or not. And I have relatives in Nebraska, and it's going to go Republican by the same token. But you have these states with incredibly narrow margins that I just talked about, where you have to pay acute attention to what's going on in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Arizona, Nevada. And if you like, you can add Florida and Virginia to that list. But Virginia is the real bellwether of the story. Because Virginia went for Biden in 2020. And Republican strategists of the right realized that they had lost white suburban women, partly because of Trump's record in terms of issues having to do with male and female relations, shall we say. Women were not comfortable with Donald Trump. So they went back and said, all right, what is the vulnerability of these people? Well, in order to win Virginia for Youngkin, they looked at the vote-rich suburbs of Washington, D.C. And they said, okay, these parents are exhausted from COVID. Their nerves are frayed. Their kids are in and out of school, and everybody's nerves are frayed. And they also fear that their kids are getting displaced by affirmative action. And, you know, there are a lot of politics going on in schools that make them uncomfortable. So they picked up this term of critical race theory and erroneously applied it to elementary and high schools, even though it doesn't apply. And it became a kind of label for anything that dealt with race relations in American history in less than a rosy fashion. And so they were able to organize around this. You know, sometimes they would cherry pick incidents and sometimes they would just tell lies. Teachers are making children apologize for being white. I don't think that's really how teachers in our country function. If they're teaching about slavery and kids feel bad that slavery happened, that is probably appropriate. I did a lot of research on this. And you know, even one of the cases that they were citing was a teacher training in Rhode Island, where it talked about unfortunate events that happened in our history. Well, Rhode Island was the major business center of the slave trade. It's where ships were built and enslaving voyages were carried out. So either you could say that's not true, but it is true, or you can say it's not unfortunate. I think it's unfortunate. Or you should say kids shouldn't have the basic knowledge. Of course, you don't say to kids that it's your fault, you weren't born then. But it is part of understanding human history. But they're not interested in the facts on that level. They're interested in taking these frayed nerves and provoking emotions in the same way that they say Democrats like to murder newborn babies. You know, that makes you emotional. It's not true, but it makes you emotional. So they set up trainings for people to go in and disrupt their school boards. It's gotten really ugly. There are some school districts where the innocent school board member who's there to advocate for math instruction finds dead vermin on their doorstep and they get death threats on social media. Really ugly. They disrupt these communities. They disrupt these schools. They inject their own people on school boards, which are also a pipeline for local aughts. So then on the way, they can go from school board to precinct chairman to local election official to state election official and have all of these radically right-wing people moving through the pipeline into public office through this poorly defended entry point. And children and teachers and other parents are paying the price. And in fact, a lot of Republicans are paying the price. A lot of Republicans are people who've simply voted for the Republican Party over the years. Are not party to this. And in many cases, they have no idea that people who supported the insurrection on January 6th are running for office to oversee our future elections. If they did know, they probably wouldn't like it. So part of what needs to be done is A, focus on the states that are going to be the levers of power. B, focus on the swing voters and the inactive voters who are going to make a difference. And let people know what's at stake. Do you really want an insurrectionist to be calling the shots in your election? I don't think so. You want people who follow the rules, not the people who are trying to overthrow your entire community and our entire public life through criminal means.
Thanks for that, Anne. You know, one of the things I've kind of been able to follow, but not nearly as much as I'm sure you have been able to, given your expertise, is what's happening in Canada. With fascist henchmen, along with some truckers, really not that large of a group, have seemingly shut down the city of Ottawa in border crossings between Canada and the US. And now rumors about this kind of, I'm going to put this in quotes intentionally, quote unquote, protest spreading to the US with, in my opinion, Fox News fanning the flames. If you could talk about what do you think is going on here? What is this about? And how should we understand the role of, as your book title kind of speaks to, the shadow network behind it?
So this is a totally orchestrated event. And the reporting is still in its early stages because this is a relatively recent news story. But the indications are that once these organizations have been challenged on Facebook and Twitter, many of them have moved on to a platform called Telegram. A lot of the organization is going on through Telegram. A lot of the local groups that are funding the Canadians are coming out of the United States. And there are even suggestions that some of them are coming from Russia. There needs to be more investigation into that angle. But certainly the ones from the United States are being documented. So let's think about the truckers. I used to work for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the CBC, and I have a lot of friends in Canada. I really have strong interest in it. And Canada is 80% vaccinated. Canada has a history of, let's say, when there's a protest, you can have 500,000 peaceful protesters marching against war or marching for the environment. That's what Canadian protest has looked like in the past. So here, what they have figured out is that you don't need many people to get into trucks to make a big theatrical moment. So they don't have number, but they have large vehicles and they can cause all kinds of damage and chaos and disruption. So, for example, the Ottawa City Authorities just tweeted that they're jamming the 911 service right now. So they're spamming it so people with heart attacks can't call an ambulance. That's the kind of civic conscience they're showing. They're causing all kinds of disruption. And it seems to be, again, the dress rehearsal for similar actions in the United States. They're blocking the border between Canada and Michigan. There are signs that there may be something brewing in Ohio. There's indications that it's going to be apparent in the United States fairly soon, maybe even before this podcast comes out. And again, the money and the social media platforms that are organizing it are highly coordinated. So some people want to cause chaos. I recommend that people read my book because the architects of this whole movement say that they want to bring this culture down. And they have to destroy it in order to create the culture they want, which is that their right-wing fundamentalist Christian religion and their right-wing economics with no taxation for corporations and high net worth individuals wherever possible and no social programs and no public services for everyone else. That's their goal. And they don't seem to care how much human damage they wreak along the way.
I really appreciate that, both in terms of like helping us understand what this is about, but also like what this isn't about and what their goals are. Because I think a lot of times it's very, and I'm not blaming journalists here. I want to make sure that listeners are clear on this, but there is a focus in the United States that has gone on for too long on economic grievances, and that the roots of so much of this is the grievances of the working class, and it's just not true. We have repeatedly been able to show evidence that is so contrary to that. And people have to break out of thinking that. And to help you do that, check out Anne's book.
I'd like to mention that I think the people pulling the strings are people of wealth. In most, many cases, great wealth.
Yeah.
But I do feel that they have manipulated people without means. I mean, I find it vicious because, you know, it is possible to get people who have very little information and little quality education to tell them they're voting for freedom. And what that freedom actually means is that corporations are free to deposit toxic waste dumps in their community and to poison their water supply. They call it freedom, and those are the end results. And they don't have the education and the information to defend themselves. They can be persuaded to vote against their own children's education, their own children's healthcare, their own healthcare. And you've seen it. I mean, in my home state of Oklahoma, you can see it quite vividly. And if you look at a map of the United States, such as the one that was published this past week of life expectancy in the United States, the states where this culture and this political culture is dominant have a life expectancy that's 5 years less than the states that have a higher degree of information and education and a different approach to the freedom to breathe and the freedom to drink clean water and the freedom to have an education. It's a divide in the United States. I do blame the news media. I mean, I support the professional journalists, but I also feel they've had so many blind spots. And to some extent, if you look at these poorer states and these states that have been so manipulated, like my home state of Oklahoma, they've been neglected by the Democrats and by the major news media, and they've been exploited by the other side. So as Americans, I think that we should object to both of those elements.
To switch gears a bit as we start to wrap up, I wanted to move the conversation to something that we've been talking on our show a lot about. On the one hand, we keep having really important conversations with folks like yourself, Jeff Charlotte, who wrote The Family in C Street, and Dr. Anthea Butler and Sarah Posner, who wrote about the history of these Christian fascists that now have solid representation throughout the legislature and the courts. This movement that we've been discussing is dead set on seizing power and holding it by hook or by crook, and have proven it again and again and again. And on the other hand, a few months back, Biden said he didn't anticipate that the GOP would prioritize stopping him from doing anything. And that's reflected in the Democratic strategy. And I was wondering, how do you make sense of that? Is it just refusal to see the evidence, or is it something else?
I don't think there's a single Democratic strategy. And in terms of Biden, he's walking quite a tightrope. And I don't know that even with all of the powers invested in the president of the United States, either he or the Democratic Party can be the instruments to get us out of this pickle. I think that the only hope we have is some kind of massive and very well-informed civic action. What we need is a way to double down and find ways to radically engage with voters who feel threatened and uncertain and challenged and don't have access to the kind of information they need. And a lot of that will have to be done with one-to-one communication, especially to the states that matter. And it will also take civic engagement where people say, all right, I don't have much time, I don't have much energy, but I kind of need to not only run for the school board and run for the precinct chairmanship of the local Republican Party, but do it from an ethical standpoint and fight the corner for democracy. Because part of what's happened is that this other side is very energized and very coordinated. They have leadership training. They have recruiting mechanisms. They have all kinds of incentives for people. And the response has kind of been passive and hand-wringing. And all I can say is that not only have I written two books about the Nazi period in Europe, I was a journalist living and working in countries in Latin America and beyond that were dictatorships, that were military dictatorships, where people were jailed for dissent, where the press was totally censored, where people couldn't vote their will because of the controls that were imposed on them, where people were killed for their beliefs. And so I really believe that as flawed as American democracy is, it's worth fighting for. But it has to be fought for intelligently and strategically. People need to inform themselves and educate themselves. And they have to do it in a hurry because the next round is the 2022 elections.
There is a lot in what you're saying that I wholeheartedly agree with. I agree completely that this is a moment for the alarm to be ringing in such a way that no one can ignore it, that no one can put their head in the sand, that no one can keep going on pretending that it's not happening, because we really do have on our hands a danger that would not just upend people in this country's life as they know it, but really around the world. And I think that this is a moment for people to be really saying it and following that to its logical conclusion. And that's the part where I do have some disagreement and questioning, is that we have Trump and his fascist movement, which includes people within power throughout the country, throughout state legislators, throughout the judiciary, who've really torn up the norms and thrown out the rule book. And at the same time, we have a situation where the outrage and hope of people who, you know, we like to call the decent people, the people on the side of justice, keep getting diverted into the very channels that this movement is eviscerating and doing away with, and away from the deep mass society-wide struggle that I feel is needed. And to that end, you know, I do think that the Democratic Party in many ways has led people into inaction and passivity. And I think that there is a moment where we do have to have these conversations about what is it that we can do? Because if the elections are being subverted and people are being told to just vote harder, then this is a serious conundrum, doesn't even capture it. If election officials are being threatened, if they're changing who even the electors could be so that the election can be overturned, if this is the situation that we're facing, then we do have to step out of the norms. And I'm not saying that it's only going to be protests on the streets. I, in some ways, personally think we may have gone past that moment. I'm not sure. But I do think it's kind of a situation where every institution is going to have to take a stand.
Yeah, but taking a stand, they're counting on generating more conflict. They delight in protests. They find one image of any violence whatsoever. They play it across their social media platforms to say, be afraid of these people. Be afraid of Black Lives Matter. Be afraid of progressive school teachers. And they drive their voters to the polls in the states they need to win. So that is playing into their hands. That's what they want. What they want with the truckers in Canada and the ones that follow in their path in the United States is for Canada and the U.S. officials to crack down on them and have images that they can play as the repression of their free speech, which is why restraint at this moment has been a very interesting tactic. So if your goal is to get out of this crisis peacefully, and by the way, they've got all the guns.
Right.
So if it's not peaceful, you're at a disadvantage, right?
Mm-hmm.
But peacefully, they haven't subverted our elections yet. There have been some safeguards that have barely held. And, you know, Brad Raffensperger in Georgia, a Republican official. Well, There are these various states where it's underway to change these mechanics, but it's not a done deal yet. So you've got Mark Elias, who is a lawyer who is heroically challenging these election laws in state after state after state. And he's got this project that has had some losses and has also had a lot of wins. You have a project called Working America, which does de-canvassing of blue-collar voters and really establishes a dialogue with them. And it's an important initiative. You've got the American Values Coalition, which is an organization that tries to break through the disinformation in the states among evangelicals, the COVID disinformation and everything else. So you've got these initiatives that are about connection rather than confrontation. And I've seen political conflict. I've seen war. I don't like it. If there's a way to solve it through civic duty and civil courage, one hopes it can go that way. And I'm not at a point of giving up yet, but it is a time where it's all hands on deck.
I do really agree that it is a time for all hands on deck. And I think that that is a really important way to wrap up our conversation. I will say that all hands on deck to me means that we don't cede the conversation. We don't cede public discourse and the public square to those who want to take away people's most foundational rights, who seek to decimate the rule of law and civil liberties. I want to extend again my appreciation for you sharing your expertise with us, your perspective, your time. It's really valued, and I'm glad our listeners will get to hear this. We're going to put a link to your latest, the paperback, in the show notes. And how else can people read more from you?
Yeah, I've published a series of updates from the book in the Washington Spectator. And a friend of mine, Jonathan Weiner, has also published an analysis of the state legislature strategy in the Washington Spectator, which is very important. And you also have articles in the Washington Spectator about the role of the militias and military veterans by George Black. So I think that the Washington Spectator is good one-stop shopping to get chapter and verse on a lot of these issues. And also, I update my research quite a lot on Twitter as A. Nelsona.
Well, thank you so much. Take care.
You too.
All out for Tuesday, March 8th, International Women's Day. Take to the streets to declare we refuse to allow the Supreme Court deny women's humanity and decimate their rights. Abortion on demand and without apology. In New York City, 3 p.m. at Union Square. Find a protest near you. Organize one. Learn more. Volunteer. Visit riseupforabortionrights.org. I have two suggestions for recommended reading for this week. And the first is an expose by Christopher Mathias and Allie Winston that is published at Huffington Post, and it is titled Inside Patriot Front, The Mass White Supremacists on a Nationwide Hate Crime Spree. And I would also recommend that people check out As a Service, Abortion Funds Have Some Value as a Strategy, They Are Deadly by Samsara Taylor. And that is at RevComp.us. So those are two recommended readings. I'll be trying to do more of those. Thanks for listening to Refuse Fascism. I want to hear from you. Share your thoughts, questions, ideas for topics or guests, or lend a skill. Tweet me at Sam B. Goldman, or you can drop me a line at SamanthaGoldman@refusefascism.org, or leave a voicemail by calling 917-426-7582. You can also record a voice message by going to anchor.fm/refuse-fascism and clicking the button there. Want to support the show? Awesome! It's simple. Show us some love by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or your listening platform of choice. And of course, follow, subscribe, so you never miss an episode. Chip in to support our pod and content creation to help people understand and act to stop the fascist threat. You can donate by visiting refusefascism.org and hitting the donate button there, or Venmo, refuse-fascism, Cash App, refusefascism. Thanks to Richie Marini, Lena Thorne, and Mark Tinkelman for helping produce this episode. Thanks to incredible volunteers, we have transcripts available for each episode, so be sure to visit refusefascism.org and sign up to get them in your inbox each week. Again, thanks for listening. We'll be back next Sunday. Until then, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.